Hey guys, this is Priyam, your host, and we are back with another exciting episode of EngageCast. In today's episode, we are in conversation with Lars Lofgren, the CEO of Quicksprout. He has also been the Director of Growth at Kissmetrics. Lars has considerable experience in growing businesses and specializes in creating actionable CRO tactics for direct growth. In today's podcast, Lars will be talking about his learnings that he gleaned from working with folks like Neil Patel, what not to do while building a SaaS business, how to maintain the growth curve and planning the future roadmap for success, how to build high-performance growth teams that are self-sufficient, and actionable CRO tactics and growth hacks to supercharge your conversions on web and mobile. Everyone say hello to Lars Lofgren. Lars, it is an absolute pleasure to have you here with us. Without further ado, please tell the listeners a little bit about yourself.
Yes. Thanks for having me. It's absolutely fantastic to be here and I'm excited. So my background is originally in marketing. I've worked for a number of tech companies out of San Francisco, particularly in SaaS. Kind of got started there and worked my way up to running marketing teams. And from there, I actually spent some time running marketing and product in for an education company or an info product company, if you want to be more specific. Did that for a few years. And now I am working on Quicksprout and actually the CEO. So I'm running the whole team. I'm trying to get this site to a new level. And I'm really excited about what we're doing and where we're going. But my background is online marketing, lots of channels, lots of business models, and I'm happy to share anything I can to hopefully help folks not learn the same lessons I did the hard way.
Awesome. Lars, that is some CV. That is a fantastic introduction. Once again, thank you so much for agreeing to do this. We have so many questions.
Sure.
So this one very fascinating statistic that I came across is Quicksprout, right? This was a very popular name up till a while ago. Of course, traffic dipped and competitors quickly rose, and Quicksprout really wasn't the same kind of big name, that big heavy hitter tag that was associated with Quicksprout. Unfortunately, that withered away. Well, that was not a very long time ago, and until recently, after you came on board, there is a metric that comes into my mind which says traffic has increased by 74%.
Yes.
And that was in a month's time, was it?
Yeah, it was in over a couple of months. So that specific increase was, I think, from February of 2019. So yeah, February is a short month. So we're kind of, you know, we're using that as the bottom. Right. So it's a little bit in my favor. And then I think the increase was, the top hit in May. So within a few months, we've been working on the site the end of last year. So it's maybe 5 to 6 months of concerted effort. And then we saw that impact, kind of that increase over maybe like a 3 month period.
Amazing. I think that is a massive, massive number for any website. And Quicksprout deals with a massive amount of traffic already. I just did a quick check. And the numbers are absolutely huge. And I think that's a commendable effort. And we would love to find out what you have been doing.
Sure. So yeah, happy to get into that.
Yeah. So if you could probably say something that has really worked out and the first few hacks that you tried initially or the first few kind of strategic changes that you brought about, kickstart that conversions, the kickstart that traffic.
Cool. Yeah, I can, I'll give an easy one. This is probably not, it's probably the least effort item that we fixed, but it's probably not applicable to most people, which is unfortunate, but it was applicable to us, which is why we pushed on it really hard. Sure. Originally the Quicksprout URLs were not set up very well. And I'm sure if you went digging into some of the old web archives, you might be able to see what they were previously. But with how WordPress was set up, it had dates, years and months in every single URL. So it's not just the post title, but you know the year folder and then the month folder. Creates a lot of junk in the URL.
Right.
It also makes, you know, I'm sure there's definitely folks that know this in more detail than I do, but Google definitely assigns different weight to folders. You want to be careful with how you really structure your site. And if you don't do it with a lot of intent specifically around your folders, kind of give Google very confusing site architecture. And so we ripped a lot of that stuff out. We got rid of the dates and the URLs. We took the very long title URLs, which is basically just the headline of the blog post as mm-hmm. the URL, mm-hmm. stripped all that out. So now our URLs are very clean. They're all focused on a very specific keyword. That took a tremendous amount of effort to do because we literally had to set up redirects on every single URL on the site, which I think it was about 1,600 of them. So, it was a lot. But as far as the execution or the strategy, that's very simple, right? Take the URLs, clean them up. That's definitely something that's now working in our favor. Beyond that, I wouldn't say there was any hacks or like quick fixes. It was just a tremendous amount of site cleanup. So going through all the posts, finding the ones that don't get traffic and don't have any good links, we simply removed them. We deleted the blog posts. This is something that I now do on every single blog that I work on. I am more than happy to just delete blog posts, no matter how good they are. If they don't bring in traffic and if they don't bring in links, I just get rid of them. Right? I want the site to be nice and trim and lean. I don't want a bunch of dead weight hanging on the site, even if it's quality content. Right? At least that's just my approach. On top of that, we also got very disciplined with making sure all the posts, every post on the site is focused on a different topic. So a lot of teams when they run blogs, and I've definitely done this, I've done this for years, so I'm just as guilty as everyone else. So it's one of the lessons I learned the hard way.
Sure.
But, you know, if you're running a blog on conversions, right, you'll end up with 5 or 10 posts that are all on conversion tactics or right. conversion tools. Right? You see writing about the same stuff over and over. The angle is always a little bit different. The content is written from scratch. It is one of its duplicate content technically. But if it's always on the same topic, well, then you know, you ask Google to rank all that stuff. And then which one are they going to rank? Right. Can we just they either rank the wrong one or they're not sure which one to rank, so they don't rank any of them. Right. Like, ranking isn't as strong. The links also get distributed, right? Instead of having all the links coming into like one key page, it's much more spread out across the site. So you don't have a really strong page that can compete against other sites. And again, we cleaned up a lot of that stuff. We literally looked at every single URL on the site. We had this massive spreadsheet that logged every URL.
Wow.
And we one by one and said, okay, these are duplicate content, or these are duplicate topics, really. They're all on the same topic. We need to consolidate them. In some cases, we combined, you know, 4 posts into 1 mega post. In some cases, we just said, we're going to keep this one and delete the others because the content's not that good. So we took a lot of time to just consolidate and clean up the site. We basically deleted, I think, 2/3 of the site.
Wow.
Yeah, we had like 1,600 URLs. Now we're down to like 500 or 600 or something. Now, these numbers are probably wrong. But the point is we trimmed and cut out a significant portion of the site. Mm-hmm. And as soon as those changes started to go live, that's when we started seeing the increase in the traffic.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been very happy with the results so far.
Excellent, excellent. So from what I understand, this is quite fascinating, actually, because I'm sure the content at some point of time would have made a lot of sense. But unfortunately, as time progressed, it wasn't really as evergreen as we thought it would be. So the idea was to just trim the fat, basically, and boost organic visibility by ranking for most of the keywords that QuickSprout was already ranking for probably or was probably struggling in and should have ranked for. So the idea was to just go completely lean and mean.
Yeah. And this is a big change in my overall kind of content philosophy. You know, when we ran the KissMetrics blog, which our blog manager reported to me for a while. And when we were that program, we never thought about stuff like this. Like, yeah, we tried not to have, well, we never had duplicate content, but we never tried to, as long as a post had, you know, a slightly unique angle on the same topic, we were happy to publish it. And we were much more concerned about just posting volume. Let's get more posts out, right? And that was the big philosophy in SEO for years and years and years. More posts, more pages are almost always a good thing. As long as it's not duplicate content or broken pages, it's fine. But more unique pages, like, they can't hurt, right? You can, and there's always a chance to pick up some long tail SEO keywords. So why not publish it? If you got the content, publish it and keep it up. And then in this, particularly in the last few years, in that my philosophy has completely changed. It's done a complete 180. Now I only want content if it's carrying its weight. Otherwise, I'd rather have a smaller site. And not only is QuickSprout a perfect case study of the results you can get by having a trim, lean site, but I went through this the hard way with the last site that I managed, iwillteachyourtorich.com. We had a bloated site with some lower quality content, lots of old stuff that we never cleaned up. And we went through some pretty big traffic drops, you know, when Google recrawled it and realized all the crap we had. So we spent a lot of time cleaning that up. And then I didn't get the traffic back to where it originally was, but we stopped it from continuing to drop and got some of the growth back. And again, that was from cleanup, that was from removing posts, that was from being disciplined. So I've now seen this work multiple times on really massive sites, and it's now a core part of my program.
Amazing, amazing. I think what's fascinating to know is that all of these theories that you're talking about, like you keep creating more content, you know, and every SEO guy out there who's listening to this is probably nodding his head now and saying, yeah, that's exactly what we do. But the idea that things are changing right now, and the same thing that you mentioned, Google itself is struggling to rank your own content. And I think every content marketer is guilty of that. And that's a fascinating insight. I'm going to have a talk with my SEO guy tomorrow.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, you might want to go through the blog a little bit.
Definitely, definitely. So that's QuickSprout. I think that's pretty amazing. Now, your profile has also mentioned your journey with Kissmetrics, and you were the head of at Kissmetrics. What was that journey like, and what was that about?
Yeah, so that was definitely a journey. I would call it, for me personally, we'll talk about me personally and we'll talk about the company a little bit. For me personally, it was very much a trial by fire. So it was the first big startup that I worked for full time. I was very excited. Yes. Lots of optimism and gusto and all that. Started as like an entry level marketer. And then a few years later, I found myself running the departments. That was not planned. I did not seek that out from the beginning. Through a series of events, I found myself leading the marketing team, attending board meetings, and running the department. And so I definitely learned things the fast and furious way. So for me, it was a source of tremendous personal growth and an amazing opportunity. And I'm eternally grateful to Neil Patel and Heaton Shaw for bringing me on in the early days. As far as the company goes, definitely it's fairly obvious that it ran into some challenges.
Right.
It's been quite quiet for a long time. In fact, if you go to the domain, it redirects to neilpatel.com. He got a hold of the domain at some point and basically nuked the Kissmetrics blog and just redirected everything to his site. I think there's a post somewhere of him explaining how all that went down. It's interesting. So the blog is gone. The domain is, I think it's now kissmetricshq.com or something like that, if you really want to find it. It's no longer considered a heavy hitter in the analytics space. It's Mixpanel and Heap and Amplitude were sort of the main tools. Kissmetrics has sort of dropped out of the running.
Sure.
And all the competitors that were able to raise a lot more money than Kissmetrics ever raised. That's also a sign that competitors got a little bit further than we did. But I would say it's the next question that usually comes is why, you know, what happened? Why did not Kissmetrics not go on to achieve bigger things? And there's a lot to unpack there. The simplest or the core answer, I would say, is that we struggled with product market fit. And what I mean by that is in Kissmetrics' early days, we absolutely had product market fit.
Right.
People were excited about the product. We were doing innovative things. Kissmetrics actually introduced several innovations to the analytics space that are now considered standard. Things like the horizontal funnel report. Remembers from the old school days, funnels used to be vertical. And it was a board that actually analyzed what's going on. It actually looked like a physical funnel. We flipped it, right, and moved it. And then you're able to build charts into the report, and it got a lot more useful. It sounds like a small tweak, but it really changed the game. you know, Mixpanel went and copied it, which they should have because it was a good idea. Mm-hmm. And one of the other innovations we did was actually getting to true user tracking.
Right. Now,
Google Analytics has their universal tracking now. Mixpanel has it now. Everyone has it now. But in the back then, people were only doing visitor tracking. In other words, once the visitor left the website, that was it. Or event-based tracking. Mixpanel actually got started, focused on events. They really, people are users. You could just see what your total number of events were. And so now, you know, everything's tied to the user and you can kind of get that full picture. Well, Kissmetrics started all that. And during that period, you know, when we were kind of innovating and pushing the category forward, we did have product market fit. We had a lot of traction, lots of excitement. Mm-hmm. Later on, for all sorts of reasons I can get into if you want, but we sort of lost that. Our innovation tempo slowed down tremendously. We stopped innovating. We got distracted. We worked on too many things. And the market moved forward. The competitors closed the gap and then started moving the category forward without us. And we sort of lost the product market fit. I don't necessarily think we ever got there 100%.
Sure.
We were getting close. You could feel it. Feel the excitement from the customers. But over time, we did, in fact, lose it. Whatever we had, we did lose. And instead, with kind of, we had a product market fit that was eroding underneath us, we were focused very heavily on marketing and sales.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why so many people know about the brand and the blog, and we were doing a ton of webinars. And I have lots of stories from optimizing our lead flow and a lot of great successes there. But fundamentally, none of that stuff matters if you don't have product market fit and people aren't sticking around and they don't love the product, right? So fundamentally, it was got unsustainable, right? Marketing can only cover gaps on product for so long. That's sales can only really keep up for so long before the product really starts to hit all their numbers, and it's too difficult to sell. And so, you know, fundamentally, it kind of broke apart a little bit. And, now a much smaller company than it was.
Amazing, amazing. That's really amazing insights, Lars. Just following up on that question, now that you've seen like both sides of the coin, so as to say, what would you have done differently? Or if I might ask this question a little differently, what is the best way to achieve this product market fit right now in the industry today? Let's say if you are as business.
The simple answer, it is simple. It sounds almost too simple, but it does. One of those things that carries a lot of magic is just keep talking to your customers over and over. Like, you can't do it too much. Mm-hmm. And I would, the thing that I'm much more paranoid about now that I would do very differently is I would be very aware of when I'm pushing on kind of the growth engine for SaaS.
Yeah.
So do that last. I think we got the order of operations wrong. Right? Mm-hmm. Got product market fit part of the way there. And then we tried to build up this big sales and marketing engine.
Mm-hmm.
And it just, it was, it didn't work, right? Mm-hmm. It was just much too fast.
Mm-hmm.
I would have slowed way down taken that time, taken that attention, the resources that come with capital, and continue to invest in product, keeping it really dialed, lots of customer feedback, lots of customer development until we had something that, this is something the market loves. We can sell this into other businesses all day, every day. The churn is fantastic. Once we get people in, they want to stay around. We're solving their problems. This is a fantastic tool solution for the market. And now let's scale up, right? And definitely just not getting those two things out of order.
Mm-hmm.
Once you scale up, and if you have to go back to the core and fix things, it's just so much harder.
True.
Our people, the team is bigger, the product is bigger, the customer base is bigger.
Right.
And it's much more difficult to make the changes.
Right. I completely agree with that. It's like you don't solve for the basic problems and you aim for the sky or not going to work out. So Lars, in this experience of heading the growth team at Kissmetrics, and then of course working as the CEO of Quicksprout, the one biggest experience that I really want to learn from is how you have built teams, how you have built growth teams. That is one thing that a lot of marketers struggle with today. And the idea of scaling a business sounds really nice, but you of course need a very good team to back you, right? What is your philosophy when you think about this? How do you build the perfect team for growth?
Yeah, this is a big question. Probably write a book about this. I've definitely done it the wrong way many, many times. So the best place to start is real quick, so we're all on the same page, is with define growth real quick, because that how you define that kind of goes in different directions. For me, my definition of growth, I take more of a classic tech definition of growth, which is, it's not really marketing. You know, growth is a combination of product and marketing. It's sort of the intersection between.
Absolutely.
So the day-to-day, a growth team looks actually more like a product team. So it's, you might only have a handful of marketers, but most of the folks on the team should be developers, engineers, designers, folks that actually can build and ship product. The difference is, instead of focusing on core value or ticking off a feature list that sales needs in order to sell the product, that you are specifically focused on an acquisition metric of some kind and using the product to get you there. Now, depending on the products, you have different levers you can push on. Some SaaS products have the fortune of being viral. And so a growth team can go drive and optimize that virality. Things like Slack, they can optimize user invites and that entire flow. Or Zoom, they can optimize how you get other people into calls. They can go, and you know, that's all acquisition-based. For a SaaS product, and a lot of SaaS products don't have that type of user loop, and that's fine. So in that case, a growth team would focus heavily on onboarding. So you have your new users. The marketing team probably controls the homepage. That's fine. Maybe the growth team controls it. You can go either way. But as soon as people get into the sign-up flow, the growth team is optimizing that.
Right.
And driving the conversion rates up, trying to get people into the trial as smoothly and as effectively and as fast as possible, and then trying to get them to pay as quickly as possible. So that's the growth team. And the main thing I learned, or when to, as far as managing and building growth teams, the thing that I spend the most time kind of being paranoid about now is making sure that the company is in a position to really take advantage of a growth team. The mistake that I have personally made many times is building and scaling out an entire growth team too early. I see a lot of other SaaS folks doing the same thing, right? They're not growing quite like they want to. They want to kind of, or maybe they just raised a lot of money and they want to put their foot on the gas pedal and really go a lot faster. So their solution is like, well, if I had a growth team, we could optimize our conversions and then we would grow faster. Right? That's technically true. The thing that I've gone through when building out these teams is that if you don't get the timing right, you can end up spending a lot of money building a team that will only help you for a year or two. What I mean by that is I have a whole growth A/B testing program that's really dialed in. I can build a team. I can teach them how to run the A/B tests. I know what I'm looking for. I have all these rules for how to run A/B tests in order to find wins, you know, and grow the funnel and improve conversions. And that program has given me tremendous wins in my for driving leads, for increasing trial signups through my career. The problem is, you take any of those conversion rates in the funnel, and you can only drive them so far, right? Maybe you double them, maybe you triple them, but at a certain point, you're going to hit a ceiling. And you just spent the last, if you count the on-ramp period for hiring and building the team and working together, then the time that it takes to run all those tests and actually deliver results, you're talking a 2-3 year period in most cases. And you just hire designers and engineers, which are very expensive. These are very talented folks that know what they're doing and charge accordingly, answer expectations around their compensation as they should, because that's what the market bears. And you have, 1-2 years of great growth. And then what happens after that? Well, you hit a wall. Right. Now, of course, there's exceptions to this. The main exceptions being companies that are primarily driven through user loops, user invites, virality of some kind.
Right.
But Facebook doesn't have this ceiling, right? All their growth is from user-driven activity.
True.
Their growth team has tons of room to run. Same with all the other social media companies, or Uber, or I'd even say companies at a certain scale like Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
You can look through this stuff all day long.
Mm-hmm. And,
the total size of the company isn't going to constrict kind of the number of conversion wins they can rack up.
Right.
Build these teams are too early, you're going to hit the constraints of just a smaller company. There's just not that much to work with. Funnel isn't big enough. There's only one flow to optimize. And once you've optimized that, you're sort of done. And you spend all this time and money building this team, this expensive team that knows how to do one thing, which is drive conversions.
Mm-hmm.
Then if you try to switch gears and find another avenue from growth, which is usually something further up the funnel, some traffic source or working with a sales team, doing cold outreach, whatever it may be, this team of developers and engineers is not switching gears like that is very painful for them.
Mm-hmm.
For all of us, right? Because we learn how to do a certain thing a certain way, and then if we have to change that entirely, you've got to go through that learning curve all over again.
Right. It's a tough one. Right.
So what I prefer to do now is, make sure that I have at least one, if not several, really strong channels, just distribution channels that can feed the top of my funnel, whether it's SEO or paid or a sales outreach team, whatever it may be, make sure that's healthy. Again, probably stack several of those on top of each other because there's no limit to that growth, right? There's always another channel to open up, and if you get it to be profitable, great. Sure. Now you have all this opportunity that you get to stack on top of all the work you've already done.
Sure.
Then and only then, after I've done that a bunch of times and the scale's really there and I have lots of traffic to work with and, a full team of designers and engineers is rounding error in the budget. That's a good sign. If you're not really concerned about the expense, then then there's probably plenty of wins to go after there. But startups doing it too early, you're taking very precious capital.
Right.
And, if you do it right, you'll get some growth, but then you'll hit a wall. And I've gone through that twice now.
Right.
So even though I love A/B testing, I don't really do it anymore. I focus on more top of funnel growth. That's not going to happen.
Right. Amazing, amazing. So from what I understood, the idea is to first make sure that the market is there, the customers are there, and only then do you start scaling up with respect to your growth team and think about actually selling the right stuff to the right customer, basically.
Yeah, just doing it way, way later.
Right.
Don't do it early on. Don't make your only bet a growth team.
Right. Excellent, excellent. So Lars, I'll get to the CRO strategy, and you mentioned a little bit about your distribution channels, talking about the healthy ones, spending money. We'll get to all of that, but just so that we're riding this particular wave right now, I wanted to ask you one question that I ask everyone, in fact, the question of acquisition and retention, right?
Yeah.
Most companies today are struggling with the same thing, and they have this decision to make whether we continue to pour more money into our acquisition or do we actually try and focus on retention and extract the value, the lifetime value of our existing customers.
Yeah.
What do you think is the right fit for a business that is looking for unrestricted growth in the long term?
This is a fantastic question and one of the core questions, I think. If you don't know the answer to this question for your business, then I would say you don't fundamentally understand your business.
Mm-hmm.
What I mean by that is different business models demand different answers from this question. So some business models demand that you focus all of your time on acquisition.
Sure.
In other words, retention does not matter.
Sure.
Other business models, it's the complete opposite. Right, like if you don't have your retention down, you're not going to get very far. That's exactly what we went through at Kissmetrics. We got that mix wrong, right? Mm-hmm. We focused way too much on acquisition, weren't focusing enough on retention, and we sort of hustled our way through a few years of growth, got another founding, another round of funding, but sooner or later we hit a very hard wall and we just could not move any further. So the answer is it depends, and it depends on the business model. But I'll give you some clear rules of thumb. Mm-hmm. SaaS as a whole, usually in the most cases, is extremely dependent on retention.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I always start. So I talked about hitting product market fit, investing in the product, investing in customers. You almost like can't talk to too many customers with a SaaS business, right? If you really nail that, and the right market, there's this mythical thing that people talk about called the negative churn. Right? Like actually get to the point where your retention is so low, your expansion revenue is high enough to cover the few customers that are dropping out of any given cohort. You can actually get to the point where if you look from all the customers from a given month or a given year, the amount of money you're actually getting from them over time is actually expanding, even though you're losing customers. Because the customers you do have, they're buying more, they're upgrading, they're getting on higher plans. And that is an absolutely magical place to be in SaaS. That's when SaaS gets really, really exciting from a business perspective. Right. Then all you have to do is layer on just a little bit of acquisition, and it's all great, right? That's like, especially the highest growth SaaS companies, they're usually at negative churn or very close to it. And then you don't even have to be world-class at acquisition. You just have to be okay.
Exactly.
And the whole thing is just on fire, right? So
product works for you.
Yeah. So SaaS is certainly an area where the answer is usually over-invest in retention. The business model is designed for that, and that's when you really unlock the business model and things truly accelerate. When you get Kissmetrics, we got that flip-flopped, which is fundamentally why we didn't move any further than we did. Now, some business models, the answer is completely different. And actually, the last business that I worked on is much more acquisition-based. And a lot of e-commerce companies fall into this situation because, for whatever reason, the market that they're in, the buying behavior that they're in, customers within that market, they just don't purchase that often, right? You may think like Starbucks, we're going to all the time. We're always buying cups of coffee. But a lot of products aren't like that. You only buy them once a year, once every few years. Think about like a jacket, right? You buy one winter jacket, you don't need another winter jacket in most cases. You're good for the season. You can buy one next fall. So a lot of products fall into these, the purchasing behavior is much less frequent. And when that happens, you're not going to be able to get that much growth by pushing on retention, right? Because there's just not that much retention built into it. The solution, or really the only path to growth, is to really focus on acquisition. You might invest just a little bit in product or retention just to keep your customers somewhat happy, avoid any bad word of mouth and things like that. But for the most part, you'll take all the budget you have and you'll dump it into acquisition. And if you're world-class at acquisition, your company grows and it's great and it's healthy. And if there's any hiccups along the way, you'll immediately feel that. Again, it's dependent on the business model. And it's usually a function of how often people are purchasing, which SaaS is usually, they purchase every month. So you can really lean on that.
Amazing. I totally agree with that, especially the examples that you used of e-commerce and SaaS, for example. I'm totally down with you. I think SaaS is the most attention-heavy business model that comes to my mind as well. So definitely on the same page with you. Now, like I mentioned, I'm really interested to find out a little bit more about CRO, conversion rate optimization. You have mentioned so many things along the way, and you, of course, have tried and tested so many strategies, and you have seen the good and the bad aspects. And what I would like to find out is there a particular CRO strategy that you kind of apply right now, straight off the bat, knowing fully well that this is going to work? And you have figured out probably the first 5 steps that I need to do to fix this bleeding wound. Let's say the product is mobile and web.
Mobile and web, okay. Yes. So in my career, there's always been one element that's really worked for me, and it sort of ticks all the boxes, right? Like it always works. It gives a return that you can feel right away, which is fantastic. That's what we always want. The effort is pretty low. You don't have to build some giant team and all sorts of infrastructure to go find it. And it also works on every single funnel. So regardless if you're mobile, SaaS, e-commerce, some other business model, doesn't matter. It always, always works. Mm-hmm. And that one element for me is the headline. So I always go, I figure out the main funnel for the business, where the majority of the users come in, the majority of the traffic, and then what's that first sentence that gets in front of those folks. Mm-hmm. That determines or has an enormous impact mm-hmm. on how people perceive your product, whether or not they desire what you're offering, whether or not they're interested and willing to hear more. It totally sets the stage for everything else. And it's just one sentence of copy. In mm-hmm. my experience, most headlines are not that great. They're not written by world-class copywriters. That's fine. You know, most of us are not great copywriters, but that what that also means is that there's tons of opportunity there. Mm-hmm. You spend some time and work on the headline, that first sentence in whatever funnel that you're working on. So what I'll do is I'll usually sit down and, you know, I have a starting headline and I consider that my control. That's what I'm trying to beat. And I'll sit down and I'll ask people on the team how they describe the product. I'll ask customers how they describe the product. I'll get a lot of material and a lot of research and a lot of different options that so I could take the headline in a completely different direction. And then I'll start trying different options. I'll just take the copy, I'll replace it, which is very easy to do. Again, you don't need an engineer. Maybe you just need some engineer to launch it very quickly, but you can skip design, you can skip all sorts of stuff. And again, I don't even need to run an A/B test because I know if I find a winner, I'm gonna feel it. Mm-hmm. I'm going to feel it in my monthly reports. I'm going to feel it in the lead counts and the sign-up counts and the user counts. I'm going to know when I have a winner. And I'll just take the headline. I'll replace it with something entirely different. Mm-hmm. I'll let it run for a month or so, see what happens. And if I notice positive signals, I'll keep it. Mm-hmm. If I don't, I'll try something else. Mm-hmm. Usually within 3 to 5 different variations, I'll find something that really pops. And it's on headlines, on winning headlines that I found in the past, I have increased sign up flow by 20 to 30% off of just that one sentence when I found the winner. So I consider those types of improvements very achievable, very obtainable, very normal when you find a winning headline and they can make all the difference. So that's where you should start.
Phenomenal, phenomenal. 20 to 30% increase in sign-ups. I think that is amazing. I would definitely agree, being somebody from the content background. Would you recommend changing, let's say, your website copy or your mobile web copy as frequently as 3 months or 6 months? 6 months, or would you recommend sticking to something that works?
I like to stick to something that I know works. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. Now we just like going directly after the headline. That's a fairly like straightforward test or straightforward project that's likely to yield results in the short term, which is why I like going after it. But really what we're getting into, if you think about the larger picture, is we're doing some positioning work. And you know, how do you position the product within the market, irrespective of the exact headline? Mm-hmm. Positioning is sort of that larger question of how do we describe our product? What is the category our product is in? Who are our core competitors? How do we describe that? Who is our target market? Those are big, very serious marketing questions mm-hmm. that need to be answered. And if they're answered effectively, can completely supercharge your growth, but they impact every piece of marketing material. So sure. When I think about how often to change things, what I'm really, the question that I need to answer first is, does my positioning need to be changed? Now, if I've done a lot of work on the positioning and I'm confident in it, I'm going to use it for as long as it works, mm-hmm. in which case I'm going to try to avoid changes.
Sure.
Now, maybe the market shifts, maybe it evolves.
Exactly.
Then if that starts to happen, okay, I'm going to go back to that core work. I'm going to get a really deep understanding of the market. We might completely revamp the positioning, in which case everything changes. That's okay. Companies usually have to do that somewhat regularly, at least every few years, just to stay relevant, especially in tech. But if the market is necessitating a change, I'm not going to touch something that's already working. Right? So I'm going to leave it. I'm going to focus on other stuff.
Awesome. Awesome. Now, of course, a couple of points that you mentioned, don't change something that works, right? You talked about positioning as well. From what I feel, to actually know what your correct brand positioning is, you really need to be in touch with what your customers think about you. And there has to be a balance between what you actually deliver and what your customers are looking for.
Mm-hmm. And
then can you land at that positioning? So you had earlier also mentioned in during our discussion that it is very important to constantly be talking to your consumers, right? So I feel that that is also such an important factor to actually land at the right positioning, and everything else that you mentioned, copy and everything, I think so heavily dependent on actually getting that feedback loop. Right?
Yep, I completely agree.
Awesome, awesome. Another one of my favorite questions. This is a little bit to do with psychology, and I always wonder what other people think about it. What do you think is the most important factor that shapes the consumer's choices, especially when it comes to, let's say, SaaS, a customer ends up landing on your platform? Are there certain cues or are there certain factors that really help push conversions or really trigger that point where the customer thinks, yes, I have to buy this product?
Yeah, there definitely are. My opinion, one of the things I try to focus on first is to make sure that the product that we're selling has the possibility to be the core product for a particular team or a particular type of business.
Mm-hmm.
And what I mean by that is I try to avoid products that are kind of on the margins, or building a product that's on the margin. You know, it can help a team, but they can take it or leave it. And, you know, if it's not in their like top three tools that they need to use every single day, right? But, some examples of tools that fall into this. The classic is the CRM category, right? Salesforce, which is the main thing, you know, all their competitors. Not only is the sales team completely dependent on the CRM, if the CRM does not exist, the sales team does not exist. Not only are they dependent on it, but the business is dependent on it, right? The reporting is done, the tracking is done, the customer support tickets can be done on the CRM. The entire relationship with the customer is all documented in the CRM. The business does not function without that tool. I'm picking an easy example, but it does illustrate the kind of power and need that you want to hit, picking a market and a product to fulfill a need. The further you get away from those core functions, the more difficult of a time you'll have building any SaaS company. So within the marketing space, you know, marketing automation tools, email tools, you don't have a good email tool or a good marketing automation tool, emails don't get sent. Like that's a fantastic workflow. It's a fantastic need. Or G Suite is another one. People, you build a business, if you want to use a cloud-based kind of email and office suite, G Suite is right in there, and you're going to depend on it, right? It's going to be your core document tool. So the closer you can get to kind of a core need, and an easy way to ask this, or an easy way to, either through a thought exercise or through actual market research, is to ask your customers, you know, just give me a quick ranking of your top three tools. The three tools on your team that are most important to you. And if your tool never comes up, it's a bit of a problem. Mm-hmm. Right? So is there a better team that could be using your tool all the time, or a different type of job description, or a different type of business that you could get into one of those top three? That's what I try to focus on first. And so really getting into a core need that is absolutely, you know, fundamental to the day-to-day of someone at the company, or preferably even a team at a company, that's when things get exciting.
And the idea is for that insight to also reflect in the copy as well, I guess, on the record.
Yep.
Awesome. Awesome. So, Lars, how important do you think is testing when it comes to creating a high conversion strategy based on your experience?
Yeah. So if you really want to push conversions to the limit, and you really want to drive it, and you've determined that the company stage is relevant. We talked about that earlier, not doing it too soon. If you have the funding to build an entire team to really drive conversions, you sort of checked all those boxes and you're asking, you know, what, how important is testing and being methodical and being data driven and being really careful the entire way? I would answer that it's not just important, it's absolutely essential. And if you don't have that data and that testing dialed and the right system to run those tests and select winners, what you'll find, and I've talked to many entrepreneurs that have gone through this exact sequence of events, what you'll find is you'll spend a year or two doing a lot of this stuff, and the conversions are exactly the same as when you started. that is not an uncommon outcome. Okay? And it's very heartbreaking and unfortunate, but it does happen. In fact, I'd say it's the most likely outcome. Mm-hmm. So what happens if you're not really disciplined and diligent with testing and data and all this stuff is you will find winners. You'll, even if you just eyeball it and you're just trying things, you will find winners. You'll stumble into them. But you'll also find losers, and you'll launch them accidentally. In fact, it's actually really easy to do. Even if you're running tests and trying to be statistically significant, that's still really easy to do. My system's actually designed to avoid that entirely. Mm-hmm. And what'll happen is you'll get a winner, mm-hmm. and then you'll run a bunch of other tests, and then you'll launch something that looks like a winner, but it's not. And then it reduces your conversion rate a little. So you go up and then you go down. You go up and you go down. And then you do that a bunch of times in a row, and then fast forward a year or two and you're pretty much right where you started.
It's never consistent.
Yeah, it's not like a consistent stair step up in conversion rates. It's more of a wave, right? You go up, you go down, you go up, you go down. So you have to get really disciplined with everything in order to make sure you're consistently going up every single time. Mm-hmm. And you're not backtracking. Mm-hmm. Which again, very, very easy to do. Some of the few rules of thumb that I use or some of the core pieces of my philosophy for people that are interested in this. One is I don't use 95% statistical significance. I use 99.
Wow.
Basically I could spend hours and hours talking about this, and we got maybe a little too in the weeds at KissMetrics by figuring all this stuff out. But basically the short story is 95% statistical significance works if you're calculating sample size for every test ahead mm-hmm. of time. Mm-hmm. And if you have a background in statistics, you know how to do that. You know what's involved and you can do that appropriately. I don't know anybody that has that background that's not like an actual data scientist. Right. And typically folks running the tests are not data scientists, right? Yeah. They're marketers. Right. We don't have deep backgrounds in statistics.
Absolutely.
So people just sort of skip a few critical steps. They assume 95% statistical significance is always a good marker, and it's not always a good marker. And then that's where mistakes happen. The data is basically very much more unreliable than mm-hmm. people assume. At low data volumes, 95% statistical significance has a lot of issues. That's yeah. the point. Now, we did a bunch of analysis over long-term A/B testing strategies and, you know, what's required. And we did find that you can actually skip a lot of that more detailed statistics work, mm-hmm. figuring out sample sizes, being really methodical with all that stuff. We discovered you can skip that as long as you move the marker from 95 to 99. Practically, what people will see is if they use 95% statistical significance, you'll see tests that pop in to 95% and you'll get a declared winner. But if you get a little bit more data, it'll pop right back out. That happens a lot at low data volumes. 99, it's much rarer to have that happen. So that's the big one. That's the core of the program. The other thing that's very different, that I do very differently from other folks, is I will gladly shut down a test even without getting a final winner.
Mm-hmm.
What I mean by that is if I'm trying to double or triple conversion rates, I don't care about some 2%, right? You know, and this would probably change if I had enough data volume, if I was working at Amazon or something like that.
Right.
2% wins like really matter at that scale. But for most of us, they just don't change the game, right? Yeah. You need a 15% win. You need a 20% win. If you're really lucky, a 30% win. And if you just stack a few of those on top of each other, you just find three or four 20% wins on your homepage. Mm-hmm. You've now doubled conversions.
Mm-hmm.
Like, You can really feel the impact. It gets very exciting. So when things get inconclusive, if a test has been running too long, if it looks like the difference between my control is, you know, just too small to matter, I will gladly shut down the test and move on to the next idea.
Right.
And I always keep the control. That's another thing. I always, you know, whatever version is there, I assume that's the best version. And it is on the variant, the new version, mm-hmm. has to prove itself. Mm-hmm. And if there's any issues with the data, if we don't get enough data, if we don't get an absolute confirmed winner, 99% statistical significance, we throw the variant away, we keep the control. And we'll cycle through tests basically as fast as we can,
mm-hmm.
giving each one at least a chance to prove itself. But as soon as it doesn't prove itself, we just cycle on to the next test. So we're sort of throwing a bunch of stuff out there. If it doesn't look like a hot, you know, real impact variant, then we'll just move on to the next one. And you do that for 9 to 12 months. I've done this several times, several funnels. It is common for me to double or triple conversions on a funnel by running that type of program. You got to be very disciplined. You need good data. You need to be able to walk away from variants, even though you love them, even though the team loves them. Right? Everybody may love the change, but if it doesn't prove itself, you walk away. Right? So, and it does work. It works very consistently.
Awesome. Awesome. I'm actually pretty intrigued to find out that even a 5% variance can have such a massive effect on conversions in the long term. And I think that's fascinating. And the fact that you're going for 99% statistical significance, I think that just leaves very tiny amount of error and things, very small amount of things to chance. And that's just pretty amazing. I think most marketers today are probably not patient enough to follow that kind of testing procedures. I think that is...
No, they're not.
Amazing. So Lars, brings me to a few more set of questions, something that we are really passionate about over here at WebEngage, and that is the customer experience, right? Conversions at the end of the day are obviously going to be affected massively by mm-hmm. the actual experience that they have on web and mobile, wherever it is that they land. What do you think is required or is the most critical aspect for a great and consistent customer experience when we look at multi-channel?
Yeah. So one, I'd say something to be careful of, or something that does tend to break it, is actually very disciplined conversion optimization programs. It can actually work against a consistent customer experience. In fact, the companies that are exceptionally good at customer experiences and design and customer delight and sort of that way of thinking, they actually struggle with A/B tests, and vice versa. Folks that are really good at driving conversions, things can get a little wonky in the funnel. Things will get inconsistent. This is actually how you know, or you can tell a company is being like really pushing A/B tests and conversions. Mm-hmm. Things will start to look incongruent. Right? Mm-hmm. It won't make sense anymore. You'll be like, why is it that way? That makes no sense. Well, what happens is a lot of tests and a lot of conversion wins, they actually don't make sense. You try it, and it ends up being a winner, and you have no idea why. And it's completely different than everything else that you've been doing, right? The branding is a little off. The colors are off. The positioning is a little off. You basically stumbled into something that's more powerful, but the rest of the company is still using the old framework, right? And you don't even understand what the new framework is yet because you just stumbled into it. That happens a lot. So keeping the customer experience really consistent and pushing conversions to the limit, those two things are incongruent. I would say you can't have both at the same time.
Wow. All right.
And I actually don't know of a single company. I have, maybe they're out there. I have not come across a single company that is really good at both. You sort of have to pick one. Mm-hmm. Do you want to be a very data-driven company that's going to just basically follow the data wherever it goes? And things will be a little messy. You won't understand why everything is working all the time, and you're okay with that, mm-hmm. even if you're being critiqued by some design blog somewhere that says your funnel makes no sense. And you're like, yeah, I know it doesn't make any sense, but it works. That is one way to build a company. The other way to build a company is to be very consistent, that everything does make sense internally, externally. Will you leave some money on the table? Yes, your conversions will be lower, at least in the short term. The goal or the theory is that by keeping everything consistent, you're delivering a very straightforward, simple, consistent message to your market and your customers, and that's going to pay off with better branding, better word of mouth, and that could very well be true. It's not necessarily better. Neither of these are better than the other. They're just different ways to run a company. There are different levers you can pull off in different styles. And so I'm absolutely, being a CEO now, I'm absolutely 100% willing to get behind either one, but I'd want to pick one and I'd want to focus on that. I wouldn't try to build like a world-class design team that's always trying to make everything perfect and polished and consistent across every customer touch point, while also building a hardcore growth team that's essentially going to go break it all and find all these wins that don't make sense, right? So I would do one or the other. The thing I would be very weary of is not doing both at the same time. I'm not going to name names because they probably wouldn't appreciate it. I do know one company that tried it, and they ran into some pretty serious limitations with their A/B testing because they got a lot of pushback from the design team. And it was a very design-focused company. So those two cultures and styles, they don't mesh well together. Yeah. So I would do for the other, right?
Absolutely. It's a classic pull versus push kind of an approach, I think. Definitely, I know of a fair bit of brands that are going for the whole customer experience, branding, consistency kind of an approach. And I also know very, very successful brands that have done very well with the whole data-driven conversion optimization kind of an approach. Of course, yet to find somebody who is doing both of them together. Definitely. Lars, you've consulted for so many brands and so many businesses. Whenever you're building a growth strategy, has there been a standout channel of communication for you that has really amped up engagement or has given you the most amazing conversions when it comes to the engagement? So
yeah, there is. So I'll give two answers. One is just my personal preference because it's what I like and it's probably what I have the most background in. And then two, I'll give one answer for what applies to most folks. So as far as what applies to most folks, if I was the head of marketing or joined as the head of marketing at any, especially any SaaS company, any e-commerce company, maybe even any company, I would almost always start with what does the email program look like? I'm sure there's stats that says the ROI of email is always through the roof, and those stats are actually kind of unfair, right? Because email's at the bottom of the funnel, right? Mm-hmm. People have to discover you, they have to know about you, they have to sign up for something, whether it's a product, a trial, a free PDF, or just an email subscription form, they have to take action of some kind. So they're pretty far down the funnel. Mm-hmm. And that means they are very likely to purchase and become a customer or purchase again. The intent is incredibly strong. I've spent time working on businesses that had absolutely world-class email programs. I know what that looks like. I know I can build that. I can implement that. And I know the return is through the charts, right? If you're trying to get, even today, an email is definitely not new by any means. Mm-hmm. Because of its placement in the funnel, it's lower in the funnel, it's so close to that purchase opportunity. The ability to spur action to get enormous amount of engagement, to build a connection with people is just still phenomenal. I don't know of any other channel that even comes close. Mm. Usually start there, and as long as you have a mechanism to get email addresses and a clean, organic, these are people that actually want to hear from you, you can do so much from them. There's so much room to build engagement and drive purchases or additional purchases. So that's the big channel that I always like to focus on because the ROI is just so strong. As far as personally, the channel that I've seen the most results from, but this is going to be a biased answer, is SEO in my book. All the major sites that I've worked on had very developed blogs, very developed content marketing platforms. They were very SEO driven. And even though SEO is definitely pretty old at this point, it's another channel, it's not new. There's just so much volume there. The ROI, especially at scale, is incredible. It also plays to my strengths really well, which is, you know, being able to go long-term, you know, basically grind away at something for years on end before getting a payoff. Mm-hmm. That is the SEO game. it's definitely not, you can't, there's no quick wins in SEO. It takes a long time, especially when you're starting from scratch. But it's a game I'm familiar with, I enjoy personally, and the ROI is also usually tremendous. Now that's not to say that's the only way to build a company. I know folks that do incredibly well with paid media, B2B, you know, you have a huge menu of channels to go after. Mm-hmm. Cold outreach, you build a probably $10 million ARR SaaS business off nothing but cold outreach if you know what you're doing. Mm-hmm. You just stick with it. You can do events, you can do webinars, you can do all this stuff. And if you get big enough, you'll end up doing all of them. But my personal preference, just because I like it and I know I'm good at it, is usually to start with SEO and focus.
Awesome. Awesome. Our inbound marketing team is, I'm sure, feeling really vindicated right now.
Yeah, I can't say enough good things, and I still believe in the power of it.
Brilliant. I especially like the long-term game that you talked about. I completely agree with you. We've tried some things in the past, and we used to get very disappointed when we would not see it moving quick enough. And, you know, just probably a couple of months down the line, we'd see something happening. And that's what we realize sometimes.
Very normal.
Yeah, it's pretty normal. Exactly. Awesome. Lars, I think we're almost at the end, and we have one very interesting quick segment that we ask all of our guests, and this is the Express Round. And what we're going to do is we're going to ask you some very normal questions that we expect you to answer really casually.
Okay.
The only bit that is important for you over here is that you probably get maybe 5 seconds to think of an answer before we have to answer. All right?
Sounds good.
Awesome. So we'll begin. Question number one. If not a marketing professional, then who would you be?
Business owner.
Business owner. Oh, that was really quick. All right. Living the dream already.
Yeah.
Awesome. So second question. If you're not working, then what is it that you are doing?
Reading books, powerlifting, hiking.
Wow. Nice.
Yeah.
Wow, very nice. Quite a few things over there. Nice, very nice. All right. Is there any particular life quote that you stand by persistently?
My big goal right now is to build businesses with a very attractive, healthy cash flow. So not trying to build a giant VC billion-dollar business. I want a very well-run profit business.
Nice. Very nice. All right. Any ideas that you look up to?
Let's see. Still have a ton of respect for Neil Patel. Mm-hmm. My whole career got started because he was willing to give me a job. I have a lot of respect for what he's done. He and Shaw, his partner, who I still work with, a lot of respect for both of them.
Awesome. That brings us to the end of this particular podcast. Lars, thank you so much for spending time with us, answering all of those questions. We got to learn so much today. And I think all the SaaS marketers who are going to be listening to this, they are going to be in for a treat.
Fantastic. Really enjoyed it.
That is the end of another amazing EngageCast episode. I hope you enjoyed listening to our conversation. That was Lars Lofgren talking about CRO tips to grow SaaS businesses and building high-performance growth teams. Stay tuned, we will be back with another very special episode next week.